If you are just tuning in, we encourage you to go back and listen from episode one. This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
To submit a theory, a tip, a question, or comment, please email us at tips@directappealpodcast.com or call us and leave a voicemail at 732-510-0996. As a reminder, Melanie will be answering your questions in a bonus episode. So don't forget to submit your questions by July 31st via email or voicemail.
Previously on Direct Appeal.
Perhaps what's more important than what she heard is what she didn't hear. Power tools, a gunshot, anything like that. He had left her and ended their marriage much in the same way he had left me. This is what he does. If this dude were allowed to get up there and say, yeah, he'll talk to me about this. I couldn't buy a gun. He wanted one. She basically wrecks the prosecution's timeline. She could not tell if his remains had been refrigerated.
If you're saying that this nurse is knowledgeable and knows how to cut a person up, then why would you do it the way she did it? It just doesn't make any sense. Of all the blood and gore that it would take to cut somebody into pieces, all they could find was, I wouldn't even call it a sliver of skin. It was very small.
This is episode 11, A Gamble. On last episode, we examined the defense, Melanie's team. They call character witnesses, and they call a couple of other witnesses who may have been helpful, but it turns out they were limited in their testimony. So today we're going to get into some of the other evidence that the defense presented, some of the evidence they did not present, and again, another expert who may have helped their case. So let's talk about an issue that began right from the defense in their opening statements. In the opening, Stephen Toronto mentioned that Bill had a gambling issue. And he made a production of saying that, you know, if you don't pay your debts on the street, you get shot here and here, you know, one in the chest, one in the head. And this was pretty dramatic. But he also told the jury to hold us to our promises. And so he was going to have to substantiate this gambling and these monetary issues.
Did it come up at all at trial?
Not really. So
that's not a good trial move to say it in your opening statements. You would usually the opening statements contains like your
it's the roadmap to where you're going to go, right? So the record showed that there was gambling, yes, and that was established. But a forensic accountant would have shown larger amounts of money coming in and out of Melanie and Bill's joint accounts. So we actually have bank records. Melanie's, let's say her friends, family too, she's had a team of people that have been working on this since she was convicted, you know, who've been examining records and trying to find these inaccuracies. Remember, one of her friends was the one who found those internet searches that were so damning and kind of probed us to delve into their records. So now we have an analysis of their accounts. So what do we have? We have tax returns. And we have all the banking records. So we looked at the joint bank account records, plus we looked at Bill's consulting timesheets. So remember, Bill was working full-time, but he was also a part-time consultant. We have copies of the 2003 tax returns. And so we did a little bit of our own analysis. And what we found are a couple of issues here. First of all, it seems that Bill did not deposit his whole salary into their joint bank account.
Well, I'm sorry if you said this, but they have other bank accounts that you know of, or it's only the joint?
So I don't know of the other bank accounts. Mm. And so it's possible. We know it's possible that he had another bank account.
Did Melanie talk about this at all? Did you ask her if they had, did they have their own separate accounts as well as a joint account?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
However, you know, we do know spouses keep their own accounts.
Yeah.
So here's the thing though. Let me just go into this first and then you can, you know, they had a joint bank account and that's the one in which their salaries went primarily into. So they were sharing, that's the bills, the account where everything's going in and out of. But it looks like if you take a look at the 2003 tax return, it actually looks like the salaries, Bill's whole salary was not going in there. So on the tax return, it looked like Bill McGuire, his salary was $96,962 for the year.
That's pretty good.
especially in 2003.
Right. So I think that was from maybe NJIT. I'm not sure, but that was his salary.
Are they hiring?
Melanie's salary that year was $69,434. So after you deduct the federal, state, Social Security, Medicare, everything, the net pay would have been $119,416, which comes to an average monthly pay of like close to $10,000, just under $10,000. However, the average monthly pay recorded for the joint bank account in 2003 was $7,362, which leaves this big difference. Like, where's the $2,500? $2,500 a month seems to be missing from the salaries. And if you, you know, aggregate that, it's about $31,000 a year. So Bill was consulting. So his consulting fee was an additional like $33,000. So it looks like this number is almost on par with the consulting fee, which definitely suggests at the very least that he's got a separate bank account for sure. Now, is
or a suitcase under his bed with money, right?
It suggests something that he's not putting his whole salary in. It seems that there is $30,000 to $33,000 a year missing, and that's a lot per month. So
could it be, this might be silly, but could it be in like a 529, like a college account for the kids?
So that's what I was thinking, the same thing. I mean, you might he might keep salary for something else. You know, maybe, yeah, there's something for the kids, something for his wife.
Or not even that. I mean, not even having a separate account, but like people have a joint, they have a checking, a savings, a primary checking, a secondary. Right. You know what I mean? Usually there's more than one account. It looks like they had one very primary account though, right?
They did. This was their primary for sure. But I do think there's a suggestion here that there's money missing, but is it an ominous one? We don't really know that. I think there could be a number of reasons why he might have another account in which he's putting this secondary salary in it, right? But it does definitely suggest that there's got to be other bank accounts and there's money elsewhere. So that's one issue we had when we looked at the records. The second issue that comes up is that this is to me way more interesting. There were very large amounts of money deposited into and withdrawn from the joint bank account for which there's no accounting and no explanation. Now, if you look at the 2004 year, we don't use the 2004 year pretty much for this analysis or this statement. We're using 2003 because in 2004, there were some big deposits and withdrawals, but they're explained. So for example, there was, let's see, he borrowed $10,000 from his business partner in 2004. So you would have seen $10,000 going in. You would have also seen that he liquidated a stock. So he sold one of his stocks and it turns out it was a huge number, like $80,000 or something. Yeah, it must have been a stock for a while. I know he did trading and whatnot. He also sold his mother's real estate, her estate in general. If you remember, his mother passed. So there are these big withdrawals and deposits in 2004, but they are
I'm sorry, when did
explained.
He die again? It was at 2004?
Yes.
Okay.
It was April or May, right at the beginning of 2004. His mother had only passed, I think, maybe a year before him. So he settles that estate. So in 2004, there are, you know, there's big transactions, but you can explain them. In 2003, though, there is also a number of these huge transactions that are not explained. So the interesting thing is if you actually look at his records, and there's a lot to look through, by the way, we're talking about like pages and pages and transcripts, but okay, in 2003, the income from salaries combined was $88,000. But look at their net deposits.
But the income from salary should be much higher, though, based on what their salaries were.
Well, remember, Bill also might have changed jobs. I'm not really sure why that was.
Okay,
income from salaries is $88,000 there. Mm-hmm. The net deposits $216,000 for net deposits.
That's a lot.
Net deposits minus income from salaries, $127,000. Net withdrawals, $179,000.
That means in that year, they withdrew that amount of money?
Yeah.
Wow.
So factoring in the consulting pay of $33,000, which was not in the bank record, we're looking at about $95,000 of money that's unaccounted for.
Wow.
To me, this is definitely a red flag. Mm-hmm. What is this money? Where is it coming from? No idea, right? Mm-hmm. This is when, again, you call in the forensic accountant. Someone can explain what's going on here.
And the defense didn't look at this at all.
Not really. No. They did. I mean, maybe they looked at it behind the scenes. Maybe it was one of those times where according to Melanie, I don't think they ever had any type of real accounting. So you have, so you've got these big transactions. There are things that you can say about Bill's gambling records. So there are records, you know, the casinos keep records. So his records for, let's say, June 2nd, 2003 through March 13th, 2004. show a cash transaction record total of $77,450. So it's called a CTR, and this is required for currency transactions of $10,000 or more that occur within a 24-hour period. So there was CTR on 5 different days during this time frame, and there was a record of play on 11 other days. So he actually, when I looked at the total, I think it was he played on 18 or 19 days in 2003. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a lot, a little. I don't know. Yeah, it's
a lot for me because I don't gamble.
I don't gamble at all.
But it might be a little for someone who has a gambling problem.
Well, I'm saying. I don't know that we can say, is this a gambling problem? Mm-hmm. I don't think we can say it. I'm not really sure. It also clusters around a couple of days. So it looks like there are a couple of days where he maybe was on vacation. But I will say this, I did look, there were definitely separate incidents where it's just a day. It's just a day. And some of those times where I looked at, when you cross-reference them with his work records, he was supposed to be at work on some of those days.
Oh, interesting.
So he was gambling when he should have, when he was technically reporting that. No, he was at work. So a large amount of money, let's say $51,000, was reported for October 16th to 18th, 2003, when Bill and Melanie were on a trip to Atlantic City with John and Sue Rice. This is big. This is all play money, though. And I don't know that we're able to parse out what are his winnings and what is he losing, because it's just the transaction record. But look at this. There were no report of gambling winnings or losses on the 2003 tax return. He's not reporting any of this.
If anything, it's tax fraud, right?
Yeah, you're supposed to report your winnings for sure.
But it might be something even more ominous.
What you have at the end here is we can't draw any strong conclusions. I mean, you need, again, a forensic accountant. But given the amount of money that's reported by the casino, there's large amounts of money, unexplained cash going into and out of the banking account. It does beg the question, was there something going on that we just don't know about?
Did you talk to Melanie about this? Like, what?
I did, yeah.
Was Bill the one in charge of finances? Yes. So she didn't really even know what was going on.
She didn't. She said at times that she did see money going in and out and she didn't really know what it was for.
But she didn't care. I mean, I guess they're not strapped for cash. Only people I think who are struggling really are paying close attention. I could be wrong, but it seems that way.
I think they were strapped for cash though. I mean, not strapped, but I think, remember when they went to buy the house, they had to get more loans. They declared bankruptcy in 2000.
Which is crazy because they make a nice living.
But I think she also knew that Bill was, he gambled. Mm-hmm. So maybe she's just not alarmed by this. Maybe she's not checking. I don't know. I don't know who does the primary.
Wouldn't you be pissed though? I mean, I would
be freaking
at the very
livid.
Least, I'd want my own account. Like, don't touch my money.
I'd be livid.
You want to gamble away your money, fine.
Well, listen, doesn't that also support what she said? Like, yeah, I wasn't stoked about getting a new house, but at least I was tying up cash. Like, it's money he couldn't
spend.
Yeah,
that's true. No, that's very true.
So also on another interesting thing. On the 2003 tax return, there was a casualty and theft worksheet, which showed the vandalism of the Nissan Maxima. This is the stolen headlights. Mm. January 20th, March 29th, July 10th, October 2nd, and December 12th.
How many police reports validate those dates? Because you said there were some.
Yeah, right? There definitely was. Melanie remembered him filing.
Because it's also possible that he's lying to write off more loss, right? Like, it's possible it wasn't that many times.
I imagine that he had to have some police reports. I know that he had some. I just don't know how many. Is it possible that this is not true? Yeah, but going back to this questionable headlight, 2000, this is just 2003.
Yeah.
So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Those are 5 dates. 5 times the headlights are stolen.
It doesn't make any sense.
In 1 year? I mean,
why not maybe park your car somewhere different? Right? You know what I mean? Sorry. Like, it's sort of, what do they say? Like, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me, or whatever they say, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Whatever. Like,
I don't know. It might relate to when I was a federal probation officer. I had this guy who was arrested for drugs. And I looked through his rap sheet and he had like 50 arrests. And he always got arrested on like the same corner. Like, it would be like 216th and like White Plains Road or something. Whatever the
corner was.
And
it was always the same.
And so I asked him, like, dude, you got, why didn't you move corners? He's like, it was just a convenient corner.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
I was like, okay, I thought it was, you know. So.
And also, I know we talked about this, but they didn't, like, why didn't he park in like his job's parking lot?
Melanie said she thought one time they got stolen from her house, but she couldn't be sure. And I'm like, well, once in front of the house and then all that the other times no at work.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. So that might have been a mistake. So, you know, again, we just did a brief rundown. This is looking at some bank accounts, some tax returns. Is this enough to draw conclusions? No, but it's enough to raise up the flag,
reasonable doubt once again, right?
Reasonable doubt. And a forensic accountant would have been great here. If you're going to start off in your opening, like you said, saying like, you know, there's gambling, there's money issues, hold us to our promises, at least have an accountant come in and take a look and say something about it. If you don't have that in your plan,
yeah,
it's a big promise to make and not deliver on. It's a letdown.
Especially for seasoned attorneys. They should know better. Your opening statements are really important. I'm sorry, in the closing, did they talk about the gambling again? Do you know? If not, I'm curious.
It's a brief mention.
Yeah.
It's not they didn't show anything.
Yeah.
They didn't have there was no smoking gun. All right, so there's no forensic accountant. Now, does Melanie testify or does she not? This is a big question when it comes to criminal trials. And Melanie said that she was prepped. They had told her from day one, you are going to testify. You're going to clarify. You're going to bring a lot of these issues together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a question I had for Melanie along, you know, when I'd say, well, were you worried about this mistake? Were you worried about something they did? And she said, well, I was, but I wasn't so worried because I thought I would pull it all together. I'd be able to explain everything in my testimony. So she always intended to. And at some point, they kind of let her know that, yeah, we're not going to need you to testify.
They had planned the entire time and they prepped me from the beginning. You will be taking the stand, so get your head right. And be advised, because the prosecutor is fierce, absolutely fierce, and it would have been nothing nice. I think I would have held my own. I think I would have held my own. And it's funny because she's a very animated, sort of passionate person, and I kind of liken it to how I used to deal with my husband sometimes. The louder he got, the quieter I got. Now, there's only so much of that you could do, and again, it's inherently nerve-wracking. This is your life. You are on trial for your life. Everybody's looking at you. Everybody's in your mouth. Everybody's writing about what you're wearing, how your hair looks, you know, all of this other stuff. Whereas if it could just be me, her, the lawyers, and the jury in a room somewhere, it would make a big difference. During the state's case, cross-examinations went great. I started to lose faith when our case, when we switched over to our side, and when he approached me about not testifying. They basically presented it as we were so good. You know, me getting up there could only jeopardize us. And again, I've never done this before. Yeah, he said, because I spent so much more time on this than I ever budgeted for, and, you know, doing the second indictment and all of this, like, I have to get back. And if we put you on the stand, it's going to take 2 weeks, easily. And we can only stand to lose. I was disappointed, and they make you stand up and say, are you sure this is your decision and not that of your attorney? Well, yes, it's my decision, and I'm going on the advice of my attorney. You just say yes, and you sit down. You know, and I'm not going to lie, of course I was nervous, and, you know, the fact that you're on live TV every day while this is going on, of course, and the prosecutor, she was no joke. It would have been absolutely nerve-wracking, and she had what I felt was a very personal dislike of me. So what it would have become is a showdown. It would have been Melanie versus Patty. To be honest with you, that would have taken up a ton of time, and that would it have advanced the ball for us? I don't see how it wouldn't. Could it have hurt us? I could see where it could if my story had evolved, if my story had changed. But my story, with the exception of little details here and there, I mean, it's not rehearsed, obviously. That would also speak to it being untrue. But for the most part, I'm not saying anything I haven't been saying all along. And I'm not saying anything that I wasn't saying on my wiretap before I knew my phones were tapped.
So I'm not surprised that they didn't have her testify, because, I mean, all, you know, what would you say? 8 times out of 10?
No, 9 out of 10,
you
probably.
Think 9 out of 10?
Yeah, most defense attorneys don't put their witnesses on the
stand. And for good reason. Because innocent or not, they usually get torn apart, right?
Well, what happens, I think there's two issues. There's a few. The first one is, if you are caught in any lie whatsoever, even if it does not relate to the crime, you know, you lied once about the, you know, liking someone's hair. Your credibility is then damaged. And sometimes...
And they'll capitalize on that.
They will capitalize that. Well, didn't you lie once before?
Yeah.
Isn't it true that you You know, say things when they're convenient for you. Isn't it true that, you know, if they, I think they were concerned probably as well about them delving into her affair, you know, and it would go to her issues of honesty and dishonesty. I think they were definitely afraid that Melanie might not be able to hold her own. How would she come across? Would she cry? Would she get defensive? She would have gotten defensive,
I think.
What would be her actual reaction? She says she'd get quieter. Well, would it come off to the jury then as her being, again, sympathetic, unsympathetic?
Yeah, I know. There
are any number of reasons why people
don't. So do you think she should have testified?
So with all of that being said, and after everything I know, I do think she should have testified.
You think it could have helped her?
I think that I don't think it would have hurt her. I mean, well, we have the benefit of hindsight now, right?
That's true.
She was convicted. So, you know, it couldn't have hurt, like knowing what I know now. I think that Melanie would have made a strong witness. I think it's always a risk. I think one of the things she had going for her, exactly what she just said when we were just listening to her before, is she never changed her story. I can't find, I've asked
but
her that
story.
But
she did lie. She did call Easy Pass to get a chart. Like there are a lot of things they could get her with.
And they would. They would say, well, didn't you actually lie about, I think she could have explained some of the things that, I think she could have explained some of the things that were questionable. And look, no matter what, if they do well or not, every jury wants to hear from them. You know, every jury wants to hear their story, right?
And I think jury members assume that if someone is not testifying, they have something to hide.
That's exactly right.
Unfortunately, though, because that's not the case.
No, it's not the case. We know that. And I think some juries know that now, probably. But so, I mean, there are examples like, do you remember the Jodi Arias case?
How could I forget?
She testified for, I think she was up for 18 days.
Wow.
And there was all this analysis afterwards. Did she hurt herself? Did she help herself? And it went both ways. When I watched it personally, I thought she hurt herself.
How come?
Because she seemed very clearly like she was lying at certain points.
Yeah.
She seemed really narcissistic at other points. So I think she hurt herself. But then there's other cases like, the preacher's wife, Mary Winkler. I don't know if you remember her, but she killed her husband and she got up and she testified. And she testified that he was abusive and there were other things. And she wound up, you know, convicted, but with a very, like, manslaughter and a very light sentence.
And you think it's because of her testimony?
I thought her testimony probably helped her in that case.
Because it displayed her as a victim?
It seemed genuine. Mm-hmm. She seemed genuine, you know? So I think there's... the prevailing thought, I guess, from her attorneys at the time was, we did a good job. We've poked the holes that we need to poke. All we need to do is reasonable doubt.
Well, as Melanie said, though, Joe also didn't want the trial to continue on.
So that part I don't like.
That's just her opinion, though. Or that's hearsay. Is that not?
It's hearsay.
Right?
So, but he actually said to her, it's hearsay. So according to Melanie, he said, you know, it would take too long. I have other things. And, you know, he's out of pocket now. He's out of time. I mean, he does have his own, we'll come to find out some of the things that he had going on in his own life then, but.
But at the end of the day, he wants to win. So if he truly believed that it could help her.
He wants to win.
Then he would have taken the hit and let her testify. So I do believe he did probably think it was not going to help the case.
Okay. Fair enough. Like we said, most defense attorneys are not going to want to put the clients up. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. And we don't know what happened during the course of this trial. Facts might have been revealed that he didn't know that he goes, oh boy, that might not make her look so good.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, Melanie was disappointed. And I think Melanie felt like she was losing she was losing faith in Joe.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of disheartened. She wanted to testify. She thought it was the thing that she should have done. So she definitely loses faith in him. But, you know, he's able to remind her, again, we've poked some serious holes here, okay? If you look at the science or you look at some of the facts here, we have lab reports as well. But one of the things was that they had untested DNA. So they've collected from Bill's car. They collected from Melanie's car. They collected from the apartment. They also obviously are collecting the DNA from the suitcases, from the trash bags. And there's a number of items that they didn't test.
Why?
I don't know.
So when you say they, you mean the prosecution?
Yeah, the forensic science says that it didn't test.
But what kind of items are we talking?
All right, hold on 1 second. So let me get... So I wasn't able to get my hands on this at first, but then we did. So
the evidence is still sitting somewhere in a storage facility or what?
Yes.
All right.
I believe it is, yes.
So things that were not tested then could still be tested?
Yeah, Melanie's asked to have things tested.
Okay.
But you know, she hasn't prevailed upon some of that. They did test. So what they're doing is they're testing hairs, right?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of hair found in the garbage bags and in the suitcases.
Okay.
Or there's two parts of that. There's animal hair found.
What kind of animal?
They think it was dog hair.
How do they think?
I'll get to that. And then there's also actual hairs. So they found one hair that they were able to conclusively say belonged to Melanie in the suitcase.
That makes perfect sense. Why wouldn't there be her hair in her suitcase?
That was what she said. But then, as I'm looking through the lab report, she had told me this, but there's other hair.
You mean hair that doesn't match Melanie nor Bill?
Doesn't match Melanie or Bill. It doesn't match Melanie or Bill or Melanie's parents.
Or Melanie's kids, I'm assuming. Because you got to look at everyone who lived in the house, I would imagine.
I don't know if they tested it against the children. Mm-hmm. Actually, I really...
Because hair is only done by comparing, correct? Like you do hair comparison, right? So they were comparing the hairs.
Okay. Right. Yeah, you have to do it. So what happens is they tested hairs against... they tested these hairs against Melanie and her parents. And then this to me doesn't make sense. And this is something I would ask the prosecution about. So for instance, let me give you an example. They find a hair, 2-inch long, light brown head hair with root. Right next to it, they write... NEV, not of evidentiary value.
But root would have DNA.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
They wrote, so it's not Melanie's hair, clearly. And it's not, they tested her parents, I think, too.
You also know hair comparison is considered junk science, though.
I guess I do.
But the DNA.
I know a little bit about it.
So hair comparison itself is considered junk science, but the root would have DNA. So if you were to just cut a piece of your hair and you don't get the root, it's pretty much, there's really no value to it. But
this one has the root.
That's what I'm saying. If you have the root, that's DNA.
And they're saying it's not of evidentiary value. So Melanie's question was, well, why not? Because it didn't match me?
Yeah, pretty much.
They also had a lot of animal hair. So they had, I think this was what they would say, dog hair. Linda talks about this, actually.
How about the dog hair that was found in the bags with his body? Brown and white dog hair in with the body. Where did it come from? I went to the grand jury and I was pounded on that question. Do you have a dog? At the time, no, we didn't have a dog. Does Melanie have a dog? No. When did Melanie, well, she did. When did the dog die? When did your dog die? How do you know when your dog died? What kind of a dog did Melanie have? And every lawyer you mentioned it to, well, that's easily transferable, but you have to have a dog. Where did it come from? Where was this body packaged? When they found out that we didn't have animals, that was dropped.
How convenient, right? Like if they had animals, forget about it. They would have been like, oh,
forget it. And so I'm looking at the lab reports and I see different, like several different animal hairs, animal brown hair, animal hair white, animal hair light brown, animal hair white and brown. I see at least 15, I think, accounts of animal hairs that
they
found.
Independent of each other.
Yes. Well, no.
Can they tell?
Yeah, what do you mean?
You tell if it comes from a different animal? I mean, nowadays, science could easily tell probably what kind of dog it came from. They could tell like the genealogy of, you know, this came from this sort of breed, right?
They can. At the very least, Amy, they can tell that there's animal hair all over. There's a dog. They hammered Linda. Right? They asked her 100 times.
Well, when did Melanie's dog die? Could it have been?
Much earlier.
But they also got the suitcases somewhat recently or no? Or?
The hairs were found in the bags.
Oh, in the bag.
Not the suitcase. This is why that such a major thing.
So it's almost as if the hairs were on his body, probably.
On his body or somewhere where someone was putting them in the body.
They must have had a dog that shed a lot if there's that many found.
Well, not really if you think about it. I mean, our dog walks and 15 hairs fall off for like one stride.
I don't have a dog, so I don't know. Okay.
So there's all these animal hairs, which I think are extremely questionable. And I went through—
Did they check his car for animal hairs?
They checked his car for everything, and I don't know that any animal hair came from his car.
I guess
car.
Maybe it would have come up if it had.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming they checked her car because they would have loved to be like,
They checked her car for sure. And there were different hairs, by the way. There was animal hair. There's also a couple, like I read you, the light brown hair. There was also, and I saw it in the lab report, there was an untested pubic hair.
What?
In Bill's underwear.
So I'm assuming they know it's not his.
Well, yeah, they found a pubic hair that was tested and was his, and then they found the one that wasn't.
So someone else's pubic hair was in his underwear?
Yes.
I mean, it is possible. It's just from like he had like a sexual encounter and yes. It got stuck in his pubes and it transferred out, you know?
That's a great summary. That's great.
But you know what I mean? Like, but still, why would they? I would want to talk to a hair or a scientist who'd be able to talk about this a little more. Is it not hers? Did they conclude it's not Melanie's?
Yeah.
Okay. So
they only found, from what I reviewed the reports and from what I could see, they only found one hair in the suitcase that matched Melanie's.
Okay. So they checked the pubic hair. They checked that it wasn't his or hers.
I'm going to say, I don't know how they did that, but well yes.
Comparison. You could ask Melanie, but I know sometimes defendants, they'll pluck a pubic hair.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
This is one of the arguments I think that, you know, Joe is saying to Melanie, like we're punching a lot of holes here, right? So we have untested DNA that's not yours. We have the absence of DNA and blood in the apartment. I think that was a strong point. I think that was a strong point for them. And I think they knew that was a strong point for them. I think her team kind of thought that explanation from Patty was somewhat, you know, ludicrous. So like, I don't think they believed that anyone was going to believe that she did this, this crime, you know, this awful crime in her apartment. And they didn't find anything.
I think I mentioned this before. I'm not going to reveal yet what I think about her guilt or innocence, but I will say that there is no way that prosecution proved their timeline/story.
Yeah.
He was not killed in that apartment.
Well, they would later on say, I mean, you probably know this already, but they don't have to prove a crime scene.
They don't, I know.
They don't have to, but in some instances, you really want them to make it fit with, or, you know, to understand how something happened. And if it happened, you do want a crime scene for some, not all crimes.
Their story doesn't make sense on several accounts.
So there's absence of DNA. There's these dog hairs. There's no fiber matches to the bullet. If you recall, there one of the bullets was found. It had some fibers on it. And so they took all of Melanie's furniture. They took pillows. They took lots of things and they couldn't make a match. There was a weight set or part of a weight set, a couple that were found in the suitcases. If you remember, there was like one had, I think they put 5-pound weights. Uh-huh. And so the prosecution attempted to match that to a weight set that Bill had. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was like the same, maybe even the same manufacturer, but it wasn't the same weight set. So there wasn't a match there. They weren't able to establish that.
And I'm assuming they had no proof of Melanie buying weights or, you know, you said they combed through receipts.
Yeah, no, they couldn't match anything there. So that was also, you know, again, they have no match there. They have no print matches. So fingerprints. They had a latent print on one of the garbage bags, but it wasn't a match to Melanie or anyone in her family. And actually, this is really interesting. This was an interesting point. There was a detective, because we had several detectives who were working different angles of this case.
But, on the prosecution side.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there was a detective working on the prosecution side, and he testified about this. And it was actually specifically to this issue, okay? This was Detective Machoka, and he was asked a total of 6 times by their defense attorney, Steve Toronto, if a latent palm print was found on one of the bags that was recovered with the remains of William McGuire. And each time he answered yes. Mm-hmm. Immediately following this testimony, there's a break. And then one of the prosecutors came back, a co-counsel, and I don't know how, I think it's Ramenshine. And he asked Makocha, he gets him back on the stand, or maybe he was still on the stand, and he asks him if he had been mistaken about which bag the palm print was on, and that wasn't the latent palm print found on a bag that was recovered from Bill's trunk of his car and not from one of the suitcases. And to this question, Machoka said, oh, yes, you know, I must have been mistaken.
It's weird.
But six times before, he said it was the palm print on the bag from the suitcase. And there's 2 state's exhibits. There's 2 reports. So state exhibit 493, it is an investigation report dated December 16, 2004. It was authored by Donald Makocha, stating that John Gurkowski called to advise him that a partial latent print was obtained from a plastic bag inside one of the suitcases.
Okay.
So he puts that down. A second report dated June 16, 2005, also authored by Donald Makocha, stating that John Gurkowski advised him that Melanie McGuire's palm print did not match the latent obtained from a plastic bag found in one of the suitcases that contained Bill McGuire's remains. So he's got it twice in a report. He was saying that, you know, someone advised him that they found this and it wasn't a match. He says 6 times on the stand that, you know, it was. And then he suddenly says, I was mistaken and I must have thought it was on another bag.
But why would the prosecution be worried, because clearly the prosecution was like, oh no, this isn't good. But the prosecution claimed she had an accomplice. So the prosecution could have just argued, yeah, it wasn't Melanie's print. She had an accomplice. It was theirs.
Yeah, they could have. Right? I'm not sure if this
and
is
then
even...
they could have tested it against Melanie's father and been like, oh, he wasn't there either. Right?
Yeah. It irks me a little bit. It bothers me this a
little bit. It's slimy again. You know, it just seems like they're...
It feels wrong. And it feels like, I mean, yeah, you could say it was accomplice, but it feels like, again, the big point or one of the big points here, there's a handprint. There's a latent print on a garbage bag inside the suitcase. So basically on the bags, whoever, you know, put Bill in those bags, there's a print and it's not Melanie's.
And the prosecution doesn't need the jury to know that because it doesn't fit with their story.
Possibly. I mean, it doesn't, right?
Like I said, unless it was the accomplice, but.
So I guess, you know, what's the takeaway from this? You know, we're talking about the DNA, we're talking about the fiber matches, the apartment. The takeaway here is that I think the, you know, Joe and the team felt that the forensics, you know, they were weak. There was a lack of all this trace evidence.
It's so grisly as to pretty much negate the possibility that anybody could do this without leaving forensic evidence behind. Virginia Beach, when they were up here investigated, they were able to contact the people who had been involved with the move. One of my friend's cousins was present and was there, and he ended up taking, I think, one or two of our couches, some of the bags of Bill's clothing, because, you know, at this point, bear in mind, we've not been notified. We're packing up, we're moving, and I'm not aware he's dead. I'm home. I'm on the couch. I'm not at this move. So I think the idea with the clothing at that point, that had already been packed up. You know, it's been made a lot out of that. Oh, she just, you know, got rid of his clothes like 2 days after she found out, you know, that he was dead. Well, they were all in bags already, because in my mind, again, I'm getting divorced and I'm moving. The detectives were able to visit this young man named Justin, and they were able to obtain from Justin clothing, the black trash bags that the clothing was in. That's how they did some of their comparisons. In fact, they also got the couch, the throw pillows. They compared all the fibers they could essentially get their hands on. Apparently, there was some concern. One of the bullets had a wad of white fiber around it, which they thought ultimately represented the fact that it was shot through a pillow. They did all of these comparisons and found nothing. And this gentleman as well was able to tell them that he himself had seen the mattress. The mattress was pristine white, that the mattress had gone to the dump. And even though there's no formal report of it, I'm reasonably certain that they went and swapped that mattress, because it was like a couple days later. I'm pretty sure they could have gotten to that dump, and who knows, but at the very least you can see it's not soaked in blood.
Okay, so she's just establishing what we just discussed, mm-hmm. right? That they didn't find anything. There's nothing in the, you know, there's nothing in the apartment. There's no fibers that are matching. You know, everything's pristine. So they have a lack of or weak forensic evidence in this case. And I think that was, something, you know, if we have to look at things that were working for them, as Melanie said, nothing really worked because she wound up where she did. But mm-hmm. I'm going to say this is their strong point. They mm-hmm. have no crime scene and they really can't establish what happened. There's no forensics here, or very little forensics. Agreed?
I agree.
Okay, so let's move on. So Melanie's losing faith, but one of the strong witnesses they had actually was a handwriting expert by the name of Carol Chasky. Mm-hmm. She's a forensic linguistic specialist. She was brought in because there were two letters written to the prosecution. The prosecution contended that these letters were written by Melanie in an attempt to obstruct justice and throw them off of her trail. One letter, they call it the mob letter, mm-hmm. was a letter supposedly from the real killer. And I think that it had to be, because it contained some factual accuracies about Bill's murder, which indicates that the person who wrote it either was a part of the crime or knew who was.
Couldn't it be someone who was just close to the investigation? Or there were things that the public didn't know, or there, you know.
Well, you could say there were things that maybe it was leaked by the investigation, but yeah. There were things in the letter that was not known to the public.
But so, known to obviously the detectives and the prosecution. Like yes. There were a lot of people who knew this information. You don't know who tells who what, you know?
No, you don't. No.
I'm sorry, and when was this letter received? During the trial, or was it?
This was before the trial, but it was later. If you recall, in the beginning, we discussed Melanie was indicted twice.
Yeah.
So this was the second indictment. So okay. It was a good time after Melanie was arrested. I mean, we're talking about probably a year or 6 months to a year, something mm-hmm. in that time frame. So before the trial, but after, way after the first indictment. We have two anonymous letters. One is called the mob letter, and the second one is called the set her up list. And both of these, the prosecution contended, came from Melanie.
In October of 2006, I'm indicted because a number of anonymous communications have been received. The attorney general, the press, there were several different mailings. So we were preparing for that with a linguistics expert. So we ended up actually spending a good deal of money on linguistics. There was a lot of back and forth with a piece of anonymous communication as well that had some things in it that were attributed to basically have been from Cindy's house, a school calendar, things like this. And I think this was one of the ones that went solely and directly to Patty's office. They found DNA and fingerprint on different forms of this communication that didn't match anybody. Again, when you put Dr. Chasky up there, this is the stuff that I was ultimately acquitted of.
So the letter that she's talking about, we've both seen it before, purportedly it's from a mobster explaining why Melanie McGuire could not have killed her husband. It talks about Bill McGuire. They refer to him as Billy Mac.
That sounds like a mob name.
It does, actually, yeah. It's saying that he was a gambler and that he had a big mouth and that, they refer to her, the wife a couple of times. It doesn't paint him in a positive light. And it looks like it's trying to, take focus off of Melanie. And then at the end, they conclude that there are some facts that, should finally convince you. So again, the letter is kind of saying that Melanie didn't have anything to do with it. And, you should probably look at, some of his other areas. And in the end, it says, I'm taking the liberty of sending this to the media in case you want to close your eyes to this. As you've done in everything else in this case, I'm sending it to the wife's lawyer. The way the articles read last year made it seem like his
arms were cut off.
Does that say arms?
Yeah.
The way the articles read last year made it seem like his arms were cut off. They weren't, which they were not.
They weren't cut off?
No, they were. No, remember the torso was intact.
Oh, gotcha.
The head, the arms, okay. Everything were intact. He was wearing nothing but purple briefs
and that's
when
true.
You found him. Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Ever figure out where the weights came from? Now, do you believe me?
I don't think the weights.
But the purple briefs part is.
And that wasn't made public?
No.
Okay.
That was not made public. Nothing I saw in any reports were. So, you've read through this letter before. I've read through this letter.
It's written very well.
The letter's written very well.
Are we going to be posting this on the website?
Yes, we are. We're going to post this mob letter on the website.
Yeah, I would love to hear other people's opinion. I think it's...
I mean, it says things like, you love to gamble, love to flash cash.
Yeah.
I'd see him at AC at some private games. The funny part is that he was a pretty good player, but his ego wouldn't let him lose.
I'm curious, did you talk to Melanie about this? It says... ask his wife about the steakhouse in North Jersey and about an unfortunate accident coming home from work there late one night. He didn't tell her was he wasn't working. He had lost a bundle, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm wondering, obviously, we're going to think Melanie wrote this, right? But let's assume she didn't, right? Does she know the reference to these things? Have you spoken to
her? Yeah, she knows about that one. He wasn't working. He lost a bundle that night. I heard him talk about getting pulled over on top of that, and it was her fault. I laughed. You can't be serious, man. She takes that from you, that and more. She did know this incident, actually, because they did get into a huge fight over it. He called her one night. He got pulled over, and he was yelling at her on the phone. And I don't know, maybe she was yelling back. I'm not sure the full extent of this fight, but she was upset enough that she left the house in the middle of the night and went driving around and mm-hmm. called her mother, who was like, what are you doing? Go home. Her mom said that later she didn't know what was going on, but that was an incident. But also, there's no way to substantiate that.
There is something interesting, though. It talks about how... you know, in the letter, it says he talked about Virginia and how that was where he was going once he made his money here and how his wife hated it. So he did get angry at Melanie because he wanted to live in Virginia, but she didn't, correct?
Yes.
So it makes
hearsay,
sense.
But yes.
Like, yes. So it makes sense that if he wanted to get away and leave the wife and kids, he's going to go to Virginia. And that's where his body was found. I mean.
But his car was found in Atlantic City.
Yeah, that's true. Damn it. Okay, I forgot about
it. I know,
that.
I know. I understand, you're right, but the car is in Atlantic City.
Unless he had like an accomplice that he was going with.
So he's got an accomplice
maybe,
now?
I don't know.
My impression of this letter is that it looks like it was very, what Amy just said, very well written. I also thought, to me, it reads like a woman trying to write like a man.
How come? Somewhere in particular?
There were a lot of different places, actually, where I thought it sounded like how someone would think a man would talk, but it wasn't. I'd have to look back and reference a couple of them. But
I thought he was either gay or sexually bent. He said his wife was so stupid. Hold on. When she asked him why he got pissed and told her even that couldn't help him get it up for her, nice guy, Billy Mack. I mean.
No, you're not seeing it.
I do think that it's talking a lot about, you know, it's trying too hard to defend Melanie. Like, why does this person care so much?
Right.
You know, it says, did it dawn on you that Miss McGuire, in her quote unquote selfish plot to kill her husband, didn't bother to wait for him to actually purchase the insurance? Oh, and she's got the boyfriend with the money. She didn't need it. Why would anyone who would pass on $2 million money or not, the $2 million, that's sort of like a man thing to say, I think. If she coaxed that boyfriend away from his happy home, how much do you think it would leave for her after he paid out his old lady?
So you see the old lady references and
yeah,
Billy Mack.
I just feel like, why would somebody care so much about trying to convince someone that Melanie didn't do it?
Yeah.
The whole letter is pretty much like defending Melanie.
It is. And there is something in the letter at some point that says like, why do I care? I don't really, just like she's getting a raw deal. I don't really care. I just figured I'd hate to see this woman go to jail and lose her children because, you know, of.
But this person's not claiming, let's say this isn't Melanie. This person's not claiming they did it. They just claim they know who did it. Correct?
It's not hurting me in any way. And I've got nothing for the wife or against her. I read about those kids. This father, they're better off without, but they don't need a ma on death row. So now it's up to you to figure it out. She can't help you much, but did you ever even ask her? I know you think this is a hoax. Well, allow me to part with some facts that should finally convince you otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, besides the underwear thing, none of the other quote unquote facts are that crazy.
I don't think any of the facts are that crazy either.
And the underwear, think of how many people are involved in the investigation, from detectives to whoever. Like, this could just be someone who just wants to, let's say it wasn't Melanie. It could just be someone who just wants to, like, I don't know, fuck with the case.
It could be anyone. Well, I mean, listen, in a minute, I'm going to get to what the experts are going to say about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
This isn't up to me and you, but
yeah.
To me, again, it just read like, for some reason, a woman who was trying to write like she thought a man would talk.
Yeah.
Like a thug kind of guy,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So that's the first piece of anonymous communication, they call it. The second piece is a list that's called the Set Her Up list. And it was supposedly sent by someone who worked with Bill's sister, Cindy. And it was sent to the prosecutor anonymously, implying that Cindy actually wrote this list.
Hmm.
So it was something to the effect of like, I found this. You know, I work with Cindy and I found this. You know, she wrote this list. And it's a handwritten note. And it's really like two pages. And it looks like things, it says, set her up. So it says, all right, let's start. Set her up. Deny that we knew about the firearm or that he made her get one. Deny that he used to move her car when they fought sometimes. Because remember, she said that was something that he did. Call prosecutors and mafia allegations to implicate her family. Have kids say they saw her do it or dispose of his body.
Oh, come on.
Final stages.
Mm-hmm.
Termination of parental rights, public statement against prosecutor, estate for boys, taunt her with not seeing kids, and we are their parents now.
What? Stupid. So that's handwritten and the other one's typed.
Yeah. This is the handwritten and the other one's typed, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the person sending that claim that they found that, it was Cindy's and they found it?
Yeah, like something Cindy wrote and discarded.
Oh, so like Cindy, so this person is claiming Cindy set up Melanie. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I think so too. But here's the question. The prosecutor's saying, well, clearly this is Melanie because who else would do this?
Yeah. All right, because that makes no sense. Well, did they check the handwriting?
So before we get to the handwriting, the defense tried to elicit from Cindy on the stand that she had prepared a list like this one before when she and Bill got into an argument with their sister Nancy. Mm-hmm. But I guess Bill and Cindy were a little bit upset when their mother passed away and they wanted to sell her estate because Nancy was holding up the sale in mm-hmm. some ways. Maybe she had questions or I don't know. They said that she was complicating the sale mm-hmm. of their mother's estate. So they wrote kind of a mean-spirited list, and it was like called Ways to Taunt Nancy. Mm. And I'm actually not going to get into the particulars of the list on,
How did they even find out about that? Melanie knew about it?
Yeah, Melanie knew about it. And Melanie, I think Melanie had it.
Okay.
So again, I'm not going to get too much into the particulars. I don't want to invade their privacy that much. Cause there were some mean spirited things in there and Cindy admitted to it on the stand mm-hmm. and said, okay, we wrote this one time over a glass of wine. We were joking. It was never meant for public consumption. Yeah. We were never actually going to do anything to Nancy. Mm-hmm. Like we were never going to hurt Nancy. Right. But Nancy provided an interview, her initial interviews with the detectives, where she seems to think that it's possible that Cindy might do something harmful to her. Nancy said she recalled fighting with Cindy over Cindy's kids. Nancy recalled one time at the Bronx Zoo, Cindy wouldn't allow the kids to have anything to drink because that would require them to have to go to the bathroom in public. She also recalled Cindy threw her out of the house in the middle of the night over a minor disagreement. Nancy said Cindy had violent tendencies and said one time Cindy placed a pillow over her face. Nancy said she didn't find it very funny.
How is any of this relevant?
Well, it is and it's not, right? Cindy said we never would have done anything to Nancy. Nancy says, well, and this might have looked, she might have given this interview on a bad day, but this yeah. was a year after Bill was murdered. And she said Cindy had violent tendencies. Melanie's camp is saying that this letter came from someone who it was Cindy that wrote it. And doesn't it make sense that Cindy wrote it when she's written a similar letter before? And she's a violent person. Yeah. Ah, now they're trying to...
I mean, whose handwriting is it? Melanie or Cindy? Or Cindy's? It's handwritten.
It is handwritten. So we're going to get to that in a second.
Okay, I'm dying to know.
Yeah, I think the point is, though, you're asking what's the relevance. I think what they're trying to establish is that maybe, you know, Cindy, whose sister says she's afraid of her and who's written a list that was very mean-spirited, also wrote this list and also has some violent tendencies and maybe had something to do with this crime.
What?
Some way, you know.
Who got Bill's money when he died? Did Cindy get it? Did...
No. And there was no money.
There was?
Like, there wasn't real money. There was a small insurance. I don't remember how much, but it was a nominal amount. It was a small amount.
So it's not like anyone... It doesn't feel like there's a financial motivation as far as someone getting his inheritance.
I don't think there was much.
So where'd the mother's inheritance go? It was split three-way between the kids?
It was split three ways. And I think they each got like $30,000.
Oh, so it wasn't enough to like kill someone over.
I think that we're killing over. I know people kill each other for less, but I don't think so. Not in New Jersey and with the middle income salaries or higher that they're, you know, making. Interestingly enough, though, I have to say, and this report again, so this report I'm reading from, I didn't just make up that line.
Yeah.
This was a report with one of the investigators, actually with Machoka. Mm-hmm. And during this time, Nancy said something else. And this was a year after. Nancy said she always believed that it was either Melanie or Cindy who killed her brother.
Nancy says that?
That's correct.
Did anyone ask her why would you think that? Or does Melanie have any?
Yes, Melanie said this. All right, let me read this. Let me go back and read this. Okay, Nancy said she always believed that it was either Melanie or Cindy who killed McGuire. She said Cindy sold her house and was having it demolished. She also said Cindy had a temper. Nancy said Cindy likes to be in complete control of everything and said Cindy wants to write down your entire life. Nancy said Cindy would have been angry with McGuire at the time because he spent the extra $7,000 from the estate on the purchase of his new house. Nancy said the price of his new home was $515,000 and it only appraised for $500,000 and said McGuire cut a deal with the owner to split the difference. McGuire gave the guy an extra $7,000. Nancy recalled this because Cindy mentioned to her when they called to inform her that McGuire was dead.
I don't know.
I mean, it's $7,000. Listen, Melanie had said at one point that when she talked to Nancy, mm-hmm. one of the first conversations after Bill passed away, that she had with Nancy, Nancy said to her, well, it was either you or Cindy who did it.
Mm.
And Melanie says, I think it's on recording. Melanie says, okay, Nance, I follow you with why you think maybe me.
Yeah.
But I'm dying to hear, like, what's with Cindy?
Yeah.
And I don't know what the explanation was other than, you know, maybe they had a disagreement or, they, you know, they had a temper, or could have their brother and sister, though. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know.
It would be a strong theory if the mother's inheritance was tied up and like it, when Bill died, the next of kin was Cindy. There, if there was some sort of financial motivation, I could almost get behind that theory.
Right, but there's not. Okay. So, I mean, she's saying, you know, but I mean, you're going to kill your brother over $7,000? I really don't think so.
No, that sounds...
But it's interesting nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes from a sister, someone who has insight. And, you know, you know what I thought was...
Unless Nancy did it.
Here's what I thought was really interesting too, okay? Did you... You heard what I said about one time Cindy put a pillow over her face and she didn't like it? Remember earlier I read the report from Marcy, Bill's first wife, and said he wasn't violent, but one time he put a pillow over her face.
Do you think it's just like a family? It's like a...
I don't know, but that's weird. It wasn't like one time she pulled or you know, pushed. Like they both at separate times put a pillow over, as reported by as hearsay.
I mean, so maybe that's what they were brought up thinking, like that's how you handle problems or something. Or you think there's some biological marker for that?
I don't know.
No, but I see what you're saying. It's just an interesting sort of
coincidence. It was something odd, so I'm putting it out there. Okay, so let's get back to this anonymous prosecution. Here's what happens. The defense, I said, retained Carol Chasky to rebut the prosecution state witness. The prosecution state witness was Jim Fitzgerald. Do you recognize that name?
Nope.
Okay.
I suppose to.
Well, he's a forensic linguistic expert. The only reason I asked if you know who this was, because he's now the subject of Manhunt. Did you guys, did you see Manhunt on Netflix about the Unabom? Okay, so he's best known for his work on the Unabom case. Uh-huh. So he's an FBI profiler and, you know, they brought him in. He's a forensic linguistic. Well, it's debated on whether or not he's a forensic linguistic expert. You know, Carol might say, this expert might say yes, he might say no, but the court allowed him as a forensic linguistic expert.
Okay, so he's an expert then.
So Jim Fitzgerald comes in. He's known for his work on the Unabom case, and he testified that there were a number of similarities between Melanie's handwriting and the communication sent to the prosecutor. So
you're not, obviously we're not talking about the typed letter. You're talking about the handwritten list of how to frame Melanie or...
Both.
Oh, because he looked at the language, you're saying. He looked at the handwriting and the language?
Yes.
Okay.
The defense calls Carol Chasky. Again, Carol Chasky is called in as a rebuttal witness. She has a PhD in linguistics. And she testified that Fitzgerald really could not make the conclusions he did based on the evidence he was given. Chasky said that Fitzgerald talked about comma placement and other things she calls forensic stylistics, but she says that's different than forensic linguistics.
Okay.
So stylistic, you know, commas, I guess
semicolons,
things of that nature. Whereas linguistics is more about the actual language used.
Okay,
I think stylistics also is comma placement, spelling.
So is one of them more likely to be correlated with? I don't know. Like, is she saying that?
She's
that's
saying
not...
that. Yeah, she's saying that that's not scientific. Is what she's saying. Like, that's not scientific. Chasky actually has a scientific method that would have enabled her to make a determination based on forensic linguistics, but the defense didn't ask her to do that. So she has.
So they just wanted her to
rebut, basically poke hole that there's no way Jim Fitzgerald could form, that he could come to these conclusions, which she did. She did good. She went in there and explained it. Now she's got a method. It's a syntactic analysis in which she uses advanced statistical procedures to determine authorship. Her method has 95% accuracy rate and it's passed a Daubert hearing. Do you know what Daubert is?
I don't know that our listeners do.
Yeah. So there's two standards for whether or not evidence can make it into a court expert testimony, and it's called the Fry standard or the Daubert. The Fry standard was first, and I think Fry was developed in maybe 1923. And that's basically a standard that says if evidence... or if a method, if science has widespread general acceptability in the field, it can be admitted into court. Later on, the Daubert standard passed. And the Daubert standard, I would say, is a little bit less restrictive. It gives the judge a little bit more leeway. The judge is allowed to use not just, it doesn't have to have solid acceptance by everyone in the field. It gives judges like a 5-factor prong. Like they can consider, you know, what the error rate is and if it's how many times it's been peer reviewed.
But
and,
it doesn't have to be that they have to get 5 out of 5.
No.
Okay.
It's just saying, you know, the Fry standard makes it clear, like it must have this. And the Daubert says, well, let's give the judge a little bit more leeway in deciding what can be expert evidence.
Which
or what can
is
be-
not necessarily the best thing. Again, you're giving a lot of discretion to someone who's not a scientist. You know?
I think so too. So you had asked also about the difference. So unlike the forensic stylistics, and that relies on word frequency and spelling errors and comma placement and other stylistic issues, Chasky's method is based on how we combine words into phrases and sentences.
Okay.
So basically what makes individuals' use of language distinctive is the pattern of simple and complex phrases used. Mm-hmm. So she is using the language that people use and the way they combine language and the way they speak to determine authorship. And she has a lot of credibility in her field. I have to say, they got an expert here. They got the top expert for the handwriting. And the jury found her testimony credible as well. I can tell you this offhand. The jury acquitted Melanie of all charges related to the anonymous communications.
So that was the second indictment that she got.
That was the second indictment. They amended it and they added these charges on. So Carol comes in and she's a very strong expert. Mm-hmm. And but you know, it is possible they can still do the analysis.
Gotcha. So at trial, she was found
not guilty of the anonymous communication. Correct.
But it didn't matter because she was found guilty of murder at that point, right? It's like, okay.
So this is one of the areas in which we're talking about the defense. And I think this was strong. They bring in the best expert, but they bring it in for the smallest charge.
Yeah, that's kind of strange.
She's clearly the best. You have to read her work.
I'm excited.
Yeah, no, she's fabulous.
And you'll be talking to her if I understand correctly.
We are. We have set up a couple of appointments to chat. She is incredibly busy. She takes part in international arbitrations.
Yeah, okay.
She's overseas a lot. I think she would like to help and would like to chat with us. So far, it's just been a problem of getting it in.
Okay, so hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Next time on Direct Appeal, Melanie was convicted of murder and sentenced to life. She and her family are devastated, but they aren't giving up. They prepare for the next fight, her appeal. Direct Appeal is hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. The story arc was written by Megan Sachs. Music and underscore by Dessert Media. Recorded, mixed, and edited by Justin Crowell at JC Studios. Special thanks to Alan Tuckerman, whose work was integral to this production.
To view photos, evidence, and engage with other listeners, visit directappealpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
If you have a tip, you can submit through our website or by emailing tips@directappealpodcast.com.
You can also help us out by leaving a 5-star review on Apple iTunes or wherever you listen.
Before we go this week, we are really excited to bring you the trailer for the second season of Mile Marker 181 by Emily Nester. Emily is a new friend who we met at CrimeCon, and despite her crazy schedule there, she was cool enough to meet up with us for a meal and some drinks and to share some of her inside tips on the podcasting world. I know many of you, just like us, have been eagerly awaiting season 2 of Mile Marker 181. So here it is.
Murder or a freak accident? A cover-up or just rumor? On November 19th, 2011, after a night out with friends, 20-year-old Jalia Davis was struck by her own car and found lying in the passing lane of I-77. Her car? Found 0.3 miles north of her body. Her clothes? Found lying over the guardrail. Her friends? The granddaughter of the former sheriff and the son of a former police officer. The rumors? Running wild. My name is Emily, and this all took place in my hometown. So, I started digging. Mile Marker 181 is an investigative journey through the details surrounding the suspicious death of Jalia Davis, which was ultimately ruled an accident by the local sheriff's department. Each episode, I go over the case documents, compare timelines and alibis, analyze phone records, speak with Jalia's family, and sometimes even uncover new information. You can listen to Mile Marker 181 anywhere you get your podcast. Listen to the facts and then decide for yourself. Accident or murder?